Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Maryland Morning. This morning, the two biggest issues facing the Baltimore City Council this summer, the minimum wage and Port Covington. On Monday night, the council voted to send a minimum wage bill back to committee. Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun and WIPR's Metro reporter Kenneth Burns were in council chambers for the debate and vote, and they'll walk us through how and why the council took this step and what it will mean for the city moving forward. Plus, Natalie Sherman of the Sun and Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal have been covering the complexities of the proposed Port Covington development for many months. They're here with a status update on this enormous project. Then, the nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, on meat substitutes. Are they healthier? And are they worth the trade-off in taste? Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Nathan's got the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan, and good morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us this morning. A reporter's notebook. We're going to take a look at two very important issues with four local journalists who are paying very close attention to them. First, in a little bit, we're going to get an update on the proposal to float bonds in an instrument called tax increment financing for the multi-billion dollar project to develop Port Covington as the headquarters for Under Armour plus residential and retail properties. But first, on Monday night, the Baltimore City Council voted to send back to committee a bill that would mandate raising the minimum wage to $15 in 2022. So to help us dissect how the City Council came to its decision and what this might mean moving forward, I'm joined this morning in Studio A by Luke Broadwater, who covers City Hall for Baltimore Sun, and Kenneth Burns, the Metro reporter here at WYPR. Morning, guys. How you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Luke, Mary Pat Clark said in your newspaper, the bill is not dead. It's resting comfortably in committee. So why did it end up back in committee? What happened?
Well, I think that's maybe a little bit of a positive spin on it. Really, they had seven votes. They needed eight votes. It's a 15-member council. She couldn't get the final vote. So bringing it back to committee as a way to preserve the bill and perhaps give it another chance at passing at a later date. Her stated reason for bringing it back was there was a problem with some language in the bill regarding disabled workers. There was an allegation from some in the blind community that the bill would inadvertently allow disabled workers to be paid less than the minimum wage, which wasn't Mary Pat Clark's intent. So they're working on that language. They're going to have a hearing on that. But what she has said is this: if they can't get a member of the city council to flip and get that eighth vote before December when a new council takes office, there's going to be several, in fact, probably many more progressive members of the council that are joining, and they're definitely going to have the votes to pass it in December. Six of the eight people who voted against the bill or were opposed to the bill are leaving the council, so it stands a very good chance of passing the council in the next term.
And Ken, does the bill have to be rewritten if it's not passed in December? I mean, I understand that if somehow January is a magic delineation, that if the bill hasn't passed sometime in December of 2016, they're going to have to start all over again and write a new bill?
That's exactly right. Much like Annapolis, once April and sine die or sine die hits, everything dies. Whatever didn't leave committee or what have you, you have to start from scratch at the next session. And this is the situation we're looking at come December when this council leaves office and the new council comes in.
They do come in December.
They come in December, yeah. And they'll have to do this process all over again. They have to rewrite the bill.
So let's talk about who voted against it. Council President Jack Young has said that he's for the $15 minimum wage, except he doesn't think, Luke, that now's the time to do it or that Baltimore should be the leader of the pack when it comes to other jurisdictions. Ricky Spector, who's leaving the council, she's retiring. Eric Costello, who is not leaving the council, he's up for re-election. Warren Branch, who's leaving. Helen Holton, who's leaving. Pete Welch, Jim Kraft, and Carl Stokes, all of whom are on their way out. What does that tell you about the depth of support for this bill?
Well, I think that when this new council comes in, it's going to be a very, very different approach. There are a couple things that could hold them up. as this new, more progressive council comes in. And that is, one, who does Jack Young appoint to be the head of that labor committee now? Because that person would have a lot of power in whether the bill even gets a vote in committee, right? So if you really wanted to be Machiavellian about it, you could sort of stack that with an opponent. The other thing is, what does the new mayor do? Everyone expects Catherine Pugh to win the election. She's been very noncommittal. And does she try to strong arm people into changing their votes? Does she introduce her own amendment? Does she veto it? Those are all questions she has not answered.
Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun, joined along with Kenny Burns, and I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. So, Kenny, Catherine Pugh has been kind of stunningly quiet about this bill. She hasn't said she's against it. She hasn't said she's for it, and neither has the sitting mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake.
Well, the mayor said she would sign the bill, but much like the people you mentioned, she kind of want to see this raised on the state level. And Eric Costello expressed this much. In fact, last week he tried to introduce an amendment that would keep Baltimore from raising its minimum wage until Baltimore and Anne Arundel counties join in. Mary Pat Clark, it should also be noted, she believes once Montgomery County passes their $15 an hour law that the state will come along.
All right, here's a woman named Ricara Jones talking about the bill and what she thinks is going to happen ultimately.
It had to go back to committee because it's not a complete bill. And we want to make sure, like everyone else, that a complete bill goes forward for the workers of Baltimore City. So we know it's not over. We just look at it as a little bit of a delay.
Union leader Ricara Jones from Union 1199. That's the service employees union. Mm-hmm. So Luke, I mean, it does sound like this bill is going to happen. It's just a matter of time. Why do you think it has to be a matter of time? I mean, one vote seems a pretty slim margin. Why wasn't Mary Pat Clark able to get this done now?
Well, I think there are really deep philosophical differences there, and on whether this is a good bill. To Mary Pat and the proponents of the bill, they see this as something that would raise wages for 90,000 Baltimoreans, that gives them more money in their pockets, that gives them more spending power and would help the Baltimore economy. The opponents think of it as like an unmitigated disaster for the city. They point to surveys of businesses that show some would leave town, some would lay off people. They point to analysis by the city's finance department that shows it would cost the economy millions of dollars every year. So if you're an opponent of this, you really believe it's a bad bill. And so I think there are some committed people there. And also there are just some followers on the council that are going to follow Jack Young's lead pretty much no matter what.
And the other concern is the city has high taxes, high income tax, high property tax, and the bottle tax. Jack Young said Monday night, he accused us of going to the county to buy some beverages because of the bottle tax.
Yeah, and there's a fee for cell phones in the city. I mean, there are fees that you encounter in the city. The water bill is going to go up by some estimates as much as 33% over the next few years. I mean, the current minimum wage is $8.75 an hour. That just kicked in. It was just raised a little bit, and it's a state bill. Working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, that's $18,200 a year. At $15 an hour, the annual income is about $31,200 a year. So it's very, very different. I mean, this is a significant difference. But I suppose, Luke, this sort of depends on which study you believe. I mean, you've got businesses saying this would be the worst thing in the world. You've got other economists and business people saying, you know, this puts money in people's pockets so they can spend money at our businesses.
Yeah, it's very interesting how people look at the economic analysis that fits their ideology already. When we were talking with Jack Young after the vote the other day, he had almost an encyclopedic knowledge of businesses that were right by the county line, every fast food restaurant, every liquor store. And he really believes that these shoppers would go elsewhere and hurt local business.
Right. Here's what Jack Young had to say on Monday night.
It puts us at a disadvantage. We already have the highest property tax in the state. Now, think about that. We have the highest property tax in the state. And then you want us to be at $15. Then we have the bottle tax. It just won't work. And that's just a statewide $15 minimum wage.
And that's just what you were saying, Kenny. I mean, as Luke said, it's estimated that about 90,000 people would be positively affected by this. About 23% of workers in Maryland now receive public assistance, even if they are working full time. So again, when we talk about the cost to the body public, the body politic, there is a social services cost, because a lot of these folks who are working for minimum wage for Walmart or McDonald's or Target are still being subsidized to a certain degree.
And a lot of these companies that you mentioned, they've long had issues about how much they pay their wages, Walmart in particular, going back to at least a decade. And I know from personal experience that Walmart had done a survey to try to bring those wages up to par, but they took out the union jobs like Safeway and Giant to see what is the real wage that they should be paying workers in a typical area.
Mm-hmm. Luke Broadwater, when it comes to this new crop of people who are expected to win in a heavily Democratic city and become a very new, comprise a very new city council. I mean, this is going to be, the majority of the members are going to be new. That means they're going to be legislative rookies. I mean, just when we talk about Machiavellian, strategies and stuff, those are going to be fairly new to these new legislators. Many of the current people who voted against the bill said during the campaign that they would support a $15 minimum wage. Do we think that John Bullock, Christopher Burnett, Zeke Cohen, Ryan Dorsey, Shannon Sneed, that crowd is in fact going to support a $15 minimum wage?
I think those five are definite yes votes. The reason I think that is, one, they do have very firm sort of, pro-populist or pro-public ideologies. And on the second is they do have union support, like the unions help them with their campaigns. And so they will feel, I think, that they owe something to the unions. The people who are in office now who said yes and then voted no, Carl Stokes, who simply answered yes on a questionnaire and then was opposed, Jack Young and Eric Costello both said yes, but with qualifications. So you could see that in their questionnaires that they're saying yes, but they really don't necessarily believe yes.
Yeah, Kenny, we just got a few seconds left, but is there any talk of a statewide minimum wage at $15 an hour? There's obviously lots of talk on it on the presidential level and in the presidential campaign, but any talk here in Maryland?
I've heard minimal talk, but nothing that pops out right now.
Okay. All right, well, we will keep talking about it. If they're not going to, we will at least. And this is something we will continue to cover. But I appreciate both you guys being here this morning and for your very, very fine reporting on this issue. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Luke Broadwater covers City Hall for the Baltimore Sun. Kenneth Burns covers all things Baltimore for WIPR. We've got a link to the reporting of both of these fine gentlemen on our website. Come on over to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, the other big issue that has been occupying the minds of the Baltimore City Council this summer, the proposed development at Port Covington. Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal and Natalie Sherman of the Baltimore Sun join me to parse out the details of this very large and very complicated project. Here's Nathan. Stay with us.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now we're going to continue our reporter's notebook with a conversation about one of the most complicated and controversial issues facing Baltimore today, the $5.5 billion proposal to develop Port Covington in South Baltimore. Sagamore Development, the development arm of Kevin Plank and Under Armour, has proposed to build what amounts to a city within a city on Baltimore's southern shore. It's a project that is slated to unfold over decades, and it has the potential to transform the city's economy and its international profile. Critics, however, are wary. They fear that it will further segregate the city and that local leaders are missing an opportunity to create not only jobs, but affordable housing and a road out of poverty for many residents. Joining me to walk us through the latest in the ongoing Sagamore saga are Natalie Sherman of the Baltimore Sun and Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal. Good morning to you both. Good to see you.
Good morning.
So, Melanie, you were at a meeting last night, which was one of several public hearings held. Last night was billed as a work session, and this is part of a group of meetings that Carl Stokes, the chair of the committee that's sort of shepherding this bill through, has been holding. What happened last night? And give us a sort of an overview on what's been going on in these previous meetings. A whole lot of people are showing up to these things.
Yes. For once, we're really seeing a lot of participation. We have seen hundreds of people show up. There's been 10 hours of hearing, public hearing testimony so far on three pieces of legislation. Last night was the first of three work sessions, which is basically kind of diving into the legislation to make amendments if needed, rewrite language, and then present the new form to the full council, possibly after Labor Day. It's really sausage making.
Right. And Natalie, one of the things that's funny about this is that people can't even those of us in the media can't agree on the number. Some people report $535 million TIF or tax increment financing. Others use the number $660 million. What's the difference between those two numbers?
So technically, they're both right. The 535 is what the developer is asking for infrastructure. And so that's what would be spent on the roads, on the parks, on the sort of projects that you've heard about. $660 million is what the city would have to borrow to get that amount of money to actually spend, because there are fees, there's interest, there are issuance costs and things like that.
A lot of this seems to come down, Natalie, to dueling studies. Build, the Baltimore United in Leadership Development, commissioned a study from a group called Tischler Buys, and then the city had a study completed by a group called Battelle Technology Partnership, and they come to different conclusions about what the impact of this project will be and what it will cost. How's anybody, including people on the Baltimore City Council, supposed to figure out who's right and who's not?
Well, that's a pretty good question. One of the things that as a reporter I've been very struck by during this process is to what extent the numbers are fluid. The development plan has changed since the project was introduced, since that first study was written. And so it is very hard to get a grip on the numbers. People are making projections. Sagamore sort of wants to change the market in Baltimore, so it's really hard to do those calculations. So I think there's healthy room for disagreement about what the impact would be. But part of that is the underlying numbers. There's not really a clear plan out there.
And Millie, you reported that although one of these studies, the one by Battelle Technology Partnership, it's been known about, but it hadn't actually been released until just last week. So what did we learn when we actually saw it in the flesh?
We didn't learn much. The trail on that study is very unusual because the Sagamore development folks, not that they ever embraced that study, and I think that they paid for part of it or all of it. And so it came out through the city because I think it was landed in a batch of documents that they gave to the city and the city posted online. But that study was asked for many months and sought after and you never received an answer. I asked for it in writing with the Sagamore representatives and they just wrote me back and said, everybody's out of town. So, but
nobody's minding the store.
Nobody's minding the store. But when the study finally came to light, it really didn't say anything new. It was everything that we had seen in testimony and heard in testimony before.
Melody Simmons of the Baltimore Business Journal. We're joined by Natalie Sherman of the Baltimore Sun. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, Natalie, you had a story a couple of days ago about the fact that Kevin Plank is buying, among other things, the water taxi service. He's got an interest in stuff around Holland's Market. He's got a whiskey business. He's got all sorts of things. So Port Covington is just sort of a piece of things that he's got financial interest in. What does this all add up to? He certainly is owning a lot of stuff in Baltimore, isn't he?
He is. I should say Holland's Market, I believe, is his brother, Scott Blake.
Oh, okay. Excuse me.
But that does not limit the truth of your statement. I think the water taxis are pretty directly related to his Port Covington investment. One of the challenges of that project is the transportation and getting there and getting people around. And so that's pretty direct.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake was on this program about 3 weeks ago, and we talked a little bit about this. And she really takes umbrage with people who are opposing this, the community groups and others who are raising questions about the numbers and about the viability and also about the guarantees or lack thereof that Sagamore is going to give. Here's a portion of our conversation.
When cities around the country take a look at the pushback that some in the community are given to this development, they're salivating. They would love to have Under Armour to invest billions in their community.
But is any of that pushback legitimate in your mind? I mean, has this been
vetted? It's not up to me to say whether it's legitimate. They can feel how they want to feel. It doesn't change the fact. It has been vetted. It's been vetted by the Board of Finance, by the Baltimore Development Corporation. Even the city council has been able to hear and ask questions of the developers. This is a project that has been vetted. This is a project that will bring jobs and resources and opportunities. And I'm proud of the work of the South Baltimore Six that came together, that took a look at this project, that said this is going to be a benefit to Baltimore, and it's going to be a benefit to our community. And it's going to be so not because the ACLU negotiated a deal for us, or Bill negotiated a deal for us, but because those communities who were directly impacted by Port Covington came to the table in their own name and with their own priorities and agenda, and sat at the table and got their needs met. And I'm extremely proud of the way that those communities stepped up to the plate and developed a negotiated an agreement that will provide job opportunities and community development for decades to come.
So, Natalie Sherman, what's your reaction to that? It's interesting to me on two levels. First, she talks about the South Baltimore Six, which are the neighborhoods in this area. But the second thing is, she's saying that these other communities around the country are salivating. They would love to have Under Armour. Given what you've been reporting about Mr. Plank's somewhat voracious acquisition of property and stuff in Baltimore, does one really believe that Mr. Plank would pick up his marbles and leave if he didn't get everything that he's asking for in this legislation, not only from the city, but from the federal government as well?
So this is something that's been really hard to get a good read on, I think. His folks always say, you know, Kevin Plank is investing in one city, and that's Baltimore, and we're committed. And as you say, they've put a lot of money where their mouth is. The city will say, we think they're looking elsewhere. But they haven't really said that much, frankly. So I don't know how much that's in play. Under Armour has locations around the country, and they've been growing, and they're not above telling people that they're signing a bigger lease in San Francisco on the day of a hearing about Port Covington. But they haven't really made big noise about that.
Because it is sort of a matter of how much leverage the city has in this negotiation, Melody. I mean, Build wants to negotiate directly with Sagamore. The unions wanted to negotiate directly with Sagamore. Jack Young has even, the president of the city council, suggested that the unions do just that. How many people is Sagamore going to have to negotiate with before something gets ironed out?
Well, what we're seeing now with with this committee and the work sessions is more of a communal negotiation that's going on in public, which is great. I think that the mayor is, I'm interested in her comments to hear her say that she thinks the whole deal should be bought hook, line, and sinker, because what we're seeing is democracy in action. We're seeing people bringing up grassroots advocates. We're seeing people who have interests in certain issues like workforce development, fair housing, and we're also going to see transparency issues. Last night it came up that they should establish a TIF website in the city to kind of promote for people to see how much the city is actually invested in all of its TIFs, not only this giant TIF. But I think when all is said and done, we're going to see a different bill. The legislation is going to be different than what's on the table right now because of all this input. And that's a good thing.
The mayor makes a lot of what she calls the Baltimore Six, those neighborhoods right around the community, Port Covington and those communities. And she says, you know, they've gotten assurances from Under Armour and from Sagamore, Natalie, that they're going to be helpful. It could mean as much as $39 million invested in neighborhoods like Brooklyn and Cherry Hill and Curtis Bay. On the other hand, the TIF is going to be underwritten by the entire city. So groups like Build are saying, look, we can't concentrate just on the contiguous neighborhoods to Port Covington. We've got to worry about the entire city. What are you hearing on the street about sentiment in that regard?
Well, I think that it's always been sort of on the table that there might be two agreements, one citywide and one for the immediate neighborhoods. And so I think, as Melody says, that's sort of what we're seeing be put together during these work sessions.
Two separate things.
Yes.
What's your guess on the timeline for this? I mean, is Labor Day going to be a demarcation? Carl Stokes has talked about slowing this down. Under Armour keeps talking about the need to fast track it and push it forward. They're saying we've got people we've got to hire. We've got to get the show on the road. Where do you think that's going to fall out?
Well, I think certainly before the council leaves. I mean, I think that's very safe to say. But yeah, I as Melody said earlier, I think we're looking at a vote sometimes this fall.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine Pugh, who is the leading contender for the Democratic or for the office of mayor, she's running against Republican Alan Walden, and she's ahead, by most reckonings. Where does she stand on this? We were just talking about the minimum wage. She's been kind of quiet about that. It seems that she's been equally quiet about Port Covington.
I agree. And she claims to, when you ask her about that, I've seen her out in the, out in the community, and she says, I am respecting the process and I'm on the sidelines. So that's where she is. Mm-hmm. We don't really know that's where she stands right now.
A lot of this comes down to whether or not the prognostications here are too optimistic. I mean, one scholar or one person who studies this thing even questioned the long-term viability of Under Armour. I mean, as a company, because let's face it, they kind of knocked Nike off its perch, but who's to say that, in 10 years somebody else is going to come along and knock Under Armour off of this? How contingent is the continued growth, contingent is this project on a continued northern trajectory for the revenues for Under Armour as an international company?
So Under Armour, the campus is 50 acres. They say it will house 10,000 people. There are currently about 2,000 Under Armour workers in the city. The rest of the development is private. Sagamore's not doing it. Under Armour's not doing it. And a lot of it is supposed to be generated by sort of spin-off business. But I think in that sense, there's a lot of room for questions about where that stands.
Yeah.
I know that I read the Under Armour, the annual report, and they are aggressively going after new business. They're trying to break into the soccer, the international soccer market with jerseys. And of course, everybody who's watching the Olympics sees that their outfits are being worn by the Fab Five on the women's gymnastics. So they are growing. We don't have any doubt about that, but we don't have a crystal ball as to where this will all lead. And I think that's one of the X factors that's been in this discussion from the start.
Sagamore has also requested about $1.1 billion in public financing for infrastructure outside the campus, like, new entrances and stuff on I-95. One of the big proposals for a grant just recently was turned down, Natalie. I mean, so the TIF in Baltimore City isn't the only piece of this puzzle that has to fit in order for this thing to happen. Where does that stand?
Yeah, so they have said that they're going to need $1.1 billion worth of additional state and public money, state and federal money. The state has basically said they're willing to do it. The federal government has been more hesitant, turned down the first grant application. They can submit again. All of the city officials have said that the city money is also contingent on Sagamore having its financing lined up for other pieces of the project. So it's a tough needle to thread.
Yeah, it's a Rubik's Cube, isn't it? And Melody, just before we finish up, we got about 10 seconds left. The impact on the schools. People are very concerned that this is going to raise property values, which is going to then be a problem for the schools.
That was debated last night. And in fact, the number $315 million potential loss to the schools was actually doubled when you look at the special education costs and some of the other costs that weren't figured in before. So it's a problem.
Yeah, and of course, we have other stuff to talk about the next time, affordable housing, guarantees of jobs, etc. But appreciate both of your work on the reporting of this and for coming in this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Melody Simmons covers real estate and development for the Baltimore Business Journal. Natalie Sherman covers those issues for the Baltimore Sun. We've got links to their great stories about Port Covington and other issues on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later, our nutrition diva tells us about the pros and cons of meat substitutes. That's coming up right after the news. But first, it's time for the Environment in Focus.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's time now for another edition of Smart Nutrition. Today, Americans and our love affair with meat. We eat 3 times more beef, chicken, and pork per person than the global average, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. And despite plenty of recent evidence that eating red and processed meats can increase our risk of cancer and chronic disease, overall meat consumption has continued to rise in the United States, as it has in other developed countries. But enough people are worried about the health effects of a meat-rich diet, about the environmental and ethical aspects of meat production, to say nothing about what we serve our vegetarian guests when they come to dinner, that they're driving a fast-growing multi-billion dollar global market for plant-based meat and dairy substitutes. So think soy burgers and vegan cheese. So putting aside how these products taste, to help us figure out whether these products are actually better for us in the long run, we're joined by our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. Hey, Monica, how you doing?
Good morning, Tom.
So this alternative to meat stuff, these meat substitutes, this is a thing, isn't it? This is like a big thing. The market share of these products is growing exponentially.
It is, and I notice it seemingly on a week-to-week basis at the grocery store, the amount of shelf spaces that is starting to be given over to these products. And I think what's really interesting here is that the number of what I think of as full-time vegetarians, you know, really committed 100% vegetarians, has not really changed in the last couple of decades. It's still hovering around 5%. But the percentage of people who sometimes eat meat that will also choose vegetarian entrees and alternatives has grown so much. So it used to be that nobody except the vegetarians was over there looking at those meat substitutes. And now a lot of shoppers are over there poking around to see what's new and trying things out and serving them on an occasional basis. And I think that's what's driving the big growth in this market.
And it's a huge market. I mean, they predict $4 billion worth of this stuff will be sold next year, and perhaps getting that number up to $5 billion by 2020. So there's a lot of incentive to develop these products, and they're developing fake everything.
And they're getting better. I mean, the selection and the variety is getting better, but also the ones, I sample a lot of them because I'm curious about it. I'm kind of a part-time vegetarian, so I'm interested to see what's out there. And I feel like the texture, the taste, the flavor, the appearance is just getting steadily better and better and better. Now, these are not unprocessed foods, you know, these...
Right. I mean,
there's a lot of manipulation going on
here. Is this a better world through chemistry? I mean, how are they making this stuff better?
Well, it's there's a lot of ingredients, and there's a product that is red hot right now. In fact, it's so red hot that I haven't been able to get my hands on yet, called the Beast Burger. And this is a meat, like a soy burger. It's actually made out of pea protein that you actually buy as raw ground beef. And it looks just like raw beef, and you can cook it on the grill, and you know, and I can't say how it tastes because I can't get my hands on it, but you know, soon. But people say that it's really amazing. But when you look at the ingredient list, there's about, you know, 40 ingredients in this thing, you know, water and pea protein and a lot of starches and gums and various things, not necessarily harmful, but this is not an unprocessed food.
Yeah, it certainly isn't. And generally speaking, they are healthier than, I mean, a Beast Burger would be a healthier thing than a hamburger. And that's because, I mean, first of all, we've talked about how when you grill anything, it increases the level of carcinogens in that product.
When you grill animal products, not when you grill vegetables. So from that perspective, it would be a way to have that backyard barbecue without incurring that particular threat. I think there are a lot of reasons that people are interested in it, to reduce their consumption of meat, maybe by replacing one or two meat items, you know, a week with an alternative. But also people are increasingly concerned with the impact on the environment, as you mentioned earlier, that the amount of meat that we're consuming creates a lot of greenhouse gases. And by, you know, going with the veggie alternatives, you can kind of lower your carbon footprint. So,
how about fat, calories, that kind of stuff? Are they, generally speaking, lower than, you know, red meat or things you might eat instead?
Sometimes, especially soy and pea protein-based, they're kind of comparable because they use other sources of fat to replace them. They're usually healthier sources of fat. They might be, you know, olive oil or canola oil or something like that instead of the beef tallow that's in a beef burger. But usually they're somewhat comparable. They're reasonably high in protein. So as a nutritional substitute, they make a pretty good swap. That's not always the case, though. There's another popular meat substitute that's made out of jackfruit. And this is a tropical fruit. We don't know
I've
it.
I've never heard of jackfruit. That's a new one on me.
Yeah, and maybe if you went out to H Mart, you know, we might be able to find them there, but I don't see them in my Giant on York Road. But it's a starchy, sort of unsweet kind of fruit that grows in Asia, and apparently its texture is just perfect, and it's been transformed. There's a few different brands using jackfruit to make things like pulled pork and barbecue and these kinds of highly seasoned meat products. Apparently, it's a great substitute in terms of flavor and texture. However, it has almost no protein in it. So that, if you were trying to kind of do a one-for-one in terms of the nutritional benefit, that might not be such a great swap.
Monica Reinagle is the Nutrition Diva on 88.1. It's our Smart Nutrition segment here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's amazing to me the vast variety of products that they're making. I mean, I've heard of Emmentaler cheese that is vegan or you know non-dairy cheese. So they're not bashful about trying to replicate stuff that you know has been in diets for centuries.
The cheese has been especially interesting to watch. There's a lot of vegan cheese out there, and of course they all make big promises, and sometimes, in my opinion, they fail to deliver. And they might be made with nut milks. Like there's some I saw a vegan brie that was fairly creditable that was made from cashew milk, but you'll also find things that are just like an alternative to a slice. American cheese that you could make a grilled cheese sandwich for your kid that's made out of things like potato starch or tapioca starch and some coconut oil to hold it all together. You know, I don't think that you would mistake it for cheese, but there's another issue there too, and that is that because it doesn't contain any dairy and it's made mostly with coconut oil and tapioca starch, it contains virtually no protein and no calcium. And those are the two things that, you know, we're used to getting from cheese. We don't need to get them from cheese. They're available from other sources. But cheese is the number two source of calcium in the American diet. And so if we're replacing that with a calcium-free version of vegan cheese, we just need to remember like, okay, then I need to make sure my kids are mm-hmm. getting their calcium from another source. But we've been trained in this country to think of dairy as our go-to fallback source of calcium very effectively. That is where we get our calcium from. So when we make those alternatives, we just want to be mindful of where we need to then be supplementing the diet with other foods that are high in calcium.
So clearly we're a long way from, you know, tofu turkey. I mean, you know,
yes.
I'll admit I was party to a tofu turkey back in the 90s and stuff. I haven't done one since then. But
I'm waiting for the tofu turducken.
All right. Well, this is really interesting stuff. Vegan fish. I mean, all this stuff, it exists.
Yeah, you can buy
it.
Canned tuna that is actually made, again, out of pea protein. They do an amazing job.
Yeah, it's wild yeah. stuff, wild stuff. Okay, always good to see you, Monica. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
My pleasure.
Monica Reinagle is the Nutrition Diva. She's a licensed nutritionist who blogs at nutritionovereasy.com. We've got links to Monica's blog and more information about meat substitutes on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday morning, a conversation with Howard County Executive Alan Kittleman on the status of historic Ellicott City following the devastating flood there 3 weeks ago. Hope you can join us. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.
I know that you feel better when you send us in your letter and tell us the name of your favorite vegetable. Send us in your letter and tell us.